Ukraine is fighting for its freedom for last several centuries, more than 400 years. And it was always a free nation that definitely would not agree for any regime. And even after Soviet or during Soviet occupation, we had a lot of people who, you know, were fighting for democratic values, also being repressed. So I believe it's just historically in Ukrainians' nature that we want to be free and we will fight for that freedom. And I hope that actually this is the final point when we will win this battle that is ongoing for centuries.
Welcome to the Voices of Open Government, a show from the Open Government Partnership, where we explore how to make our democracies more transparent, inclusive, and accountable. In this season, we're exploring some of the big issues facing democracy by talking to the reformers, activists, journalists, and citizens who are on the ground right now in the middle of the fight. I'm your host, Stephanie Bluma. When Russia invaded Ukraine earlier this year, the country was leading many promising open government reforms, from fighting corruption to giving citizens a voice. Despite the ongoing conflict, many of these efforts continue till today. And now, civil society reformers are meeting with government leaders to plan for the country's future with a continued focus on open government. Our guest today is Viktor Nastulia, the head of Eastern Europe and Central Asia at the Open Contracting Partnership, an organization that ensures contracts are open, fair, and efficient. In today's episode, Viktor talks about the democratic history of Ukraine, how the war has impacted his family and community, and importantly, about the need for open government values to lead the country's reconstruction. Viktor was in Kyiv when Russia invaded Ukraine in February of this year.
Obviously, we've been following all the messages about Russia and that they are preparing the full-scale invasion. But in Ukraine, there were a lot of, let's say, skepticism about the scale of invasion, because we were thinking about, you know, some logic and listening to our army that, okay, guys, we know that there are more than 100,000 troops concentrated next to our borders, but that's definitely not enough to invade the whole country, right? Probably with 100,000, you can invade some of the regions which are under occupation by Russia since 2014, but not, you know, go for Kyiv. You have to be crazy if you want to take Kyiv with 100,000. But most people probably were thinking that it will be only eastern part. And it was a surprise to wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning on February 24 and go through the news that actually each particular region of Ukraine was under shelling by Russians, whether it was these precise rockets or airplanes that they entered all regions from Belarus, from eastern part, from Crimea, and so on. So yeah, it was pretty hard to understand that that was a real full-scale invasion.
Like many other parents, Viktor had to explain the invasion to his young daughter. He leaned on the very popular cartoon, The Smurfs.
So generally, obviously, we were speaking with our daughter, she's 5 years old, that there are some evil forces are concentrating around Ukraine. And in the morning, it was 5:30, we woke her up and said, Victoria, do you remember when Gargamel entered Smurfs village? She said, yes. And we said, well, Gargamel is coming for Ukraine. So let's collect all the things, take all toys you want to get with you, and let's quickly go. So she mobilized really quickly, even though that it was 5:30 in the morning. You know, she wasn't crying, nothing. She just take some of her toys and we went to the car to leave the city.
And Victoria and your wife right now are safe in Vienna?
Yes.
Great. And what's it like for you in Kyiv right now?
It depends. You know, we do have air alarm or air sirens every day. So every day when Russia launches rockets, we don't know actually what city they are targeting. So the whole city is with sirens. One of the siren is just next to my window. So whether it's day or night, you hear a very loud siren sound. Obviously, everyone is getting used to that. Although it's also becoming even more risky, probably, right? Because with time, you forget about potential damages that rockets might have. So it's a little bit worrying, of course, but probably it's more worrying for my family who are now not with me, who afraid what could happen in Ukraine, in every city, basically. Because from recent events, if you've been following Kremenchuk, when Russia shelled basically shopping mall, or Vinnytsia, when they targeted the city center and the hospital, or Odessa region, when they targeted pension, basically, you know, there are no safe places in Ukraine for civilians.
In order to better understand the current conflict with Russia, I wanted to go back in time and ask Victor about Ukraine's Maidan Revolution, also known as the Revolution of Dignity. The revolution began in 2013, when then-President Yanukovych abandoned a political association with the European Union, siding instead with Russia. In response, Ukrainians took to the street to protest, eventually ousting the government.
It was a real revolution of dignity. When the whole country stepped against corrupt regime of Yanukovych, who is now hiding from justice, let's say, in Russia. And by the way, Russia tried to bring him back to Ukraine in the beginning of their full-scale invasion. So they want to have a Muppet president. But obviously they failed, and they will fail with anything they planned. But generally, the whole country united against corruption, against pro-Russian regime, against cheating the whole nation, because we were all preparing to start the EU integration process, not to actually become a member of the European Union, but to live with the Western values, you know, with freedom, with rule of law, with justice, with equal opportunities for businesses and so on and so forth. And in one day, our so-called former president Yanukovych decided to cheat everyone, right? Not signing the association agreement with the European Union, saying that we will continue friendship with Russia. So it was a historical time when the whole country said that no, that's not our choice, and we want to leave. And obviously it was hard times. More than 100 people died at Maidan Square fighting Yanukovych regime. I was personally, you know, supporting protesters, bringing some foods, bringing some clothes. So right after the revolution, in one of the central buildings of Maidan, there was a huge banner: freedom is our religion. So I believe it was one of the, you know, important values of, for all who actually went on streets in 2013. We want freedom, and we will always fight for freedom. And that's actually something that probably helps to fight Russia now. We will never give up. And Ukraine is a very free country, and every Ukrainian is a very free person.
And after the Revolution of Dignity, what happened? I mean, my understanding is some of the folks that were protesting actually joined the government in some forms and in some ways to start pushing through the reforms that they wanted to see. Can you think of a specific example where the protesters really played a role in creating reforms to help Ukraine, as you said, achieve those democratic Western values?
So Revolution of Dignity was a really unique time, and it gathered people from different spheres. At the single square, you know, people from civil society organizations, people from governments, central government or local governments who were not agree with former regime, people from businesses like small and medium businesses, cafes that were serving coffee for protesters and so on. And back then on Maidan Square, some activists called it Open University of Maidan, where they started discussing the future of Ukraine. What do we want to do when we actually win this revolution? And one of the great examples of such an outcome, let's say, was public procurement reform Prozoro.
Public procurement is the purchase of public goods, services, and works by governments. This is how taxpayers' money gets converted into roads, schools, and hospitals. It is also one of the government activities most vulnerable to corruption.
Probably one of the most famous procurement reforms globally. It was initiated by several activists who back then in Maidan Square said that, you know, we are fed up with the corruption in public procurement. We know how it's hard to win the contract, that every time you are bidding for some contracts within former government, you have to give a bribe. So corruption perception among business in public procurement was that 97% of businesses, they didn't believe that it's possible to win a contract without giving a bribe. So they just united and started discussing what can we do to change the situation. Right, so one of the first solutions that came into their mind was, let's develop a completely transparent electronic procurement system. And yeah, they just organized, received some support from businesses who believed in their idea and contributed just $35,000. And they developed an MVP, minimum viable product, of a future Prozoro electronic government procurement system that completely transformed the way how public procurement conducted in Ukraine and inspired a lot of other procurement transformation across the globe.
Well, I know we use the example at the Open Government Partnership all the time. It's really been a leading reform. Can you talk about some of the results that you had seen from Prozoro and subsequent additions to it?
For sure. After Prozoro was established in 2016, surveys showed dramatic decrease in that. Only 29% said that they think that the sphere is corrupt. Then the system helped to save, as of today, more than $7 billion United States dollars for the country by facilitating transparent auctions and reducing price of what government wanted to pay and what eventually market suggested to pay for these goods, works, or services. Average competition increased, and opportunities for small and medium businesses increased as well. So more than 80% of contracts, according to value, now in Prozoro, are won by small and medium enterprises, which is incredible figures for public procurement world. But most importantly, probably citizens' trust has significantly increased, and it helped to inspire some other open government reforms, like transparent sales and lease of public assets, by the way, also recognized by open government last December as one of transformational reforms, Prozoro sale. It helped to launch fully digital electronic healthcare systems and many, many, many others. So it really helped to show that changes are possible, and multi-stakeholder approach when actually government cooperates with businesses and citizens to transform some of the processes, it really works and helps to improve life of citizens.
And you talked about Maidan Square, about different people coming together, civil society, government, private sector. Have you seen the same sort of ability to work together in response to the invasion from Russia?
For sure. You know, from the very beginning, a lot of people from different sectors started working together to support the army, to volunteer to support internally displaced people. For example, and prepare Molotov cocktails in some of the regions just to fight against Russians. And when Mariupol was occupied and citizens needed humanitarian support like food and so on, businesses and civil society and government united all together to find all needed goods and services and to make sure that they are delivered to the city.
And why do you think that sort of commitment to democratic Western values and that unity, what do you think that comes from?
I guess Ukraine is fighting for its freedom for last several centuries, more than 400 years. And it was always a free nation that definitely would not agree for any regime. And even after Soviet or during Soviet occupation, we had a lot of people who, you know, were fighting for democratic values, also being repressed. So I believe it's, you know, just historically in Ukrainians' nature that we want to be free and we will fight for that freedom. And I hope that actually this is the final point when we will win this battle that is ongoing for centuries.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason you decided to stay in Kyiv?
Probably. You know, we discussed it with my wife, like, what should we do? And obviously, the only place I see myself in now is Ukraine. Obviously, now, you know, probably every second Ukrainian dreams about operating HIMARSes. But we can do best where we are experts. So myself working in open government sphere and knowing how procurement works, knowing how, you know, digital technologies works, how to facilitate cooperation between government, citizens and civil society and businesses, I decided to stay to support the development of future, let's say, processes required for reconstruction of our country.
And we've heard that there have been meetings within the open government community about reconstruction, about what happens. Can you talk about what exactly you're doing now and what's happening on the ground in Ukraine?
There are so many initiatives happening now. I'm working in open contracting arena, basically focusing on public procurement and public sales. So now we, together with like more than 30 civil society organizations, decided to form a coalition to support future reconstruction planning. And this coalition is called Reconstruction Integrity, Sustainability and Efficiency, or RISE Ukraine. We want to focus on several things. First one is to support the proper institutional setup and architecture for the future reconstruction, to make sure that we have all the institutions, you know, to properly track funding, to provide like all the oversights, mechanisms, complaint mechanisms, but also citizens' participation mechanisms to make sure that reconstruction planning is inclusive, it counts needs of variety of different stakeholders and so on. We also want to focus on facilitating complete transparency throughout the whole reconstruction process.
Viktor is currently collaborating with Ukraine's Ministry of Infrastructure to develop an electronic reconstruction management system,
which would be a really comprehensive solution to manage the whole reconstruction process, starting from damages identification, projects prioritization and appraisal, but also reporting through every project milestones, you know, what was procured, what was constructed, whether there are any delays, whether there are any challenges with on the construction side, with the payments and so on, to give an opportunity not only to Ukrainian citizens to track how money for reconstruction are spent, but also to all the international contributors, supporters and partners. For example, we now hear that Denmark wants to support the reconstruction of Mykolaiv region, and we want to give an opportunity to every citizens of Denmark to see what actually they as a country are supporting in Ukraine, how much they are contributing and what is happening with all the projects that they are, let's say, paying for, to understand that it's a real impact for, you know, average Ukrainian lives, and to be sure that every penny invested into Ukraine reconstruction is used openly, fairly and efficiently. So we really want to try, let's say, to establish like a new model and role model of open government on how to track infrastructure investments and maybe even inspire, you know, the rest of the world, how they can transform their approaches for reconstruction management to make it really transparent and to facilitate trust between government, business, and civil society.
Well, I personally think that's very inspiring, not only working on transparency and accountability for citizens in Ukraine, but thinking about it on the international stage. I think that's really exciting work that's taking place. The one other area I want to focus on a little is OGP Local. Obviously, that's been a growing initiative within the partnership, and a lot of what we're seeing is innovation and a creativity coming from the local level. And I know there were 3 cities in Ukraine that were already part of OGP Local, and I know Mariupol and others were working on possibly joining. But my first question for you is, do you think some of the open government values and the way open government works in terms of open budgets and letting local leaders actually control their own budgets and know what's going on in their own area, not having so much central control, do you think that's made a difference in the fight against the Russians?
To be honest, I believe that decentralization reform in Ukraine is one of the most important and most impactful reforms that were implemented over last couple of years after the Revolution of Dignity, also supported by the Open Government Partnership, to be honest. And now we have Vinnytsia, Khmelnytsky, and Ternopil, who are part of OGP Local, and just last year, you know, approved their action plans focused on sustainability, focused on inclusivity, on transparency of budget use, and so on. And as you said, more municipalities had to join this year. We are really inspired of Mariupol, which unfortunately is completely destroyed now. But Mariupol is one of the open government champions. And we documented their experience of transforming public procurement on the local level. And it's actually a role model for the rest of the world, you know, how to build a proper, really inclusive and transformative procurement system on the municipal level. It's about trust. It's about real inclusive dialogue with citizens that for sure should be replicated elsewhere. And I hope that time will come soon where we actually will be able to modernize Mariupol and to show all the greatness of these cities. But generally, decentralization of budgets, more powers on the ground, better trust between citizens and municipal local governments, it really helped to protect Ukraine from Russian invasion because people in the local communities mobilized quickly. They started working on disclosing budgets, disclosing their procurements, disclosing their decisions on municipal assets management, land management, publishing their, you know, decisions they make on a regular basis in machine-readable form, and so on and so forth. And we received a real group of municipal leaders who significantly improved trust between citizens and management. So for sure, you know, this decentralization reform helped to protect cities, and I'm sure it will also help to rebuild Ukraine. You know, we hope that resources will come and citizens, together with municipal management, will be able to plan the future of their cities or their dreams, and then obviously implement it through open and inclusive process.
Next, Victor talks about what he thinks others in the open government community can learn from Ukraine's experiences.
I guess that, first of all, it's very important to invest in trust. Right. Generally, we have a huge global crisis of trust. And what we see, how many governments are manipulated by misinformation, propaganda, and so on, just to, you know, crack the relationship between citizens and their governments. But also, let's be honest, a lot of governments are failing with supporting the relationships with citizens. In Ukraine, we were opening all decisions. We were opening every particular procurement. We opened every particular transaction starting from 1 cent. So in real time, you can see in open data. So it helped to significantly, let's say, reduce the barriers to get information on what government does, on what the decisions it makes and so on. Obviously, we can talk a lot about our challenges with fighting corruption, right? Because one thing is to be the most transparent countries, but transparency doesn't bring accountability and integrity immediately. First lesson, invest in trust. And I believe that transparency is the simplest way to start the journey. Second is important to understand both for governments and for citizens, probably, that you are not, you know, enemies. A lot of governments perceive civil society organizations as troublemakers. I think that lesson of Ukraine is civil society sometimes obviously has to cause headache because sometimes government does not listen. But even if you are causing headache with one hand, with another hand, you have to bring a painkiller, right? So if you identify a problem, always come with a solution and be ready to give a hand of support, you know, to the government. For example, with Prozoro case, it was implemented as a pure co-governance initiative. When civil society organization Transparency International Ukraine took part of the governmental responsibility and developed an IT solution that eventually was transferred to government and became a national scale electronic government procurement system. Same happened with assets declaration system, with sales system, with digital healthcare system, and with many, many other digital solutions or even transformations. So in Ukrainian case, it was a real partnership and co-governance when civil society was not only criticizing, but showing a real readiness to work together and to show that it's not just, you know, your problem, government, but it's our joint problem. And we are happy to solve it jointly in partnership as well.
Those are great lessons for everyone to take away from this. But I'm curious, what can those in the open government community and beyond, what can they be doing right now to help reformers and families that are still in Ukraine?
I guess we have several challenges now. So first, obviously, we all dream about the future of Ukraine. And we are pretty confident that Ukraine will win this war and will start its great reconstruction and modernization, not only physically, right, but generally, you know, with our policies, coming closer to the European Union and so on. But we have to understand that we are still fighting with the evil. And to win the war, we have two crucial components. First is military support, is weapons supply. And second is immediate budget relief, right? So every time we are speaking to international partners, obviously we're talking about the future dreams. But we always remind that please send us more weapons, HIMARSs, jets, and so on. And please provide us immediate financial relief so our country can pay salaries to our brave army, for example, or to doctors who are still providing treatment to everyone. We should not forget that for Europeans and for the Western world, for United States of America, the price they pay can be counted in, you know, US dollars or British pounds or euros. In Ukraine, it's human lives, right? So let's not forget about that and let's continue supporting Ukraine. And I'm sure that all these investments of open government community, obviously, you know, let's advocate for that. Please help us with that. But all these investments will pay off with the experience that hopefully Ukraine will bring to the international open government arena after we win this war. Again, I have no doubt that we will implement this completely transparent electronic reconstruction management system, that we will be able to show every citizen in the world who are supporting Ukraine reconstruction how they can track every penny that their government invests into the Ukrainian reconstruction.
The war continues to evolve daily in Ukraine. As it does, Viktor and many other reformers remain focused on fighting for their democratic rights. And, importantly, ensuring that open government values remain front and center in the Reconstruction. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. For the latest updates on open government, you can follow OGP on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Before we go, we'd like to thank OGP and our producers at Human Group Media for making this podcast possible. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you join us again for our next episode.